Hotel presents case number 13.
Recovery, the great misconception. Clancy in Midland is a speaker.
Didn't hear about him. And I've had the pleasure of introducing Clancy in many places over the last 16 years. A lot of aid places out in the ocean on the Sober Sailor's Cruise. And I've had the privilege of introducing him into the capital of the United States at our annual Yays and Nays luncheon, where 350 of the so-called top, including the non-alcoholics in Washington, the Secretary of HHS and the Surgeon General and all the biggies, we invite them over for a typical AA meeting in the Capitol. We hold it at the Sam Rayburn Dining Room. 350 people show up. We fly Clancy in from the West Coast and tell them this is just a typical AA meeting. At any rate, I've learned over the years not to make any snide remarks about our speaker. So, all I can say is Clancy has been a very positive influence in my sobriety and that of literally thousands of others, lucky members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So please join me in giving Clancy a big welcome. Clancy.
Thank you, Dr. Marley. That pick is out of my lapel. Put in the card. Good evening. My name is Clancy Imisland, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Dr. Marley for that outstanding introduction. We were just talking at dinner. He apparently has not divulged this data to others, but as a young man, he had a great honor. He was a young cavalryman in a silk stocking regiment that went off to war in 1941, before we were in the war. And the total dilettantes of the better class of New York had this cavalry regiment. While the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, throughout every military installation in the world, it said, military men, get back to your base. The Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. They could not notify young Mr. Marley and his companions. They and the other members of the Fort Riley Officers Club were off on a fox hunt. I guess the Japanese fellow wasn't any need to bother there. They'd already been taken care of. But I want to thank you, Dr. Marley, and ladies and gentlemen. This is kind of an interest. I was looking through the program, the various aspects of recovery, the various aspects, I can't say the word, and the treatment of further information and data on the puzzling illness of alcoholism. And I know that many of you are personally acquainted with alcoholism in your own lives. Some of you are not. And it's always kind of an interesting thing because each year, it seems like, a new breakthrough is made in the treatment of alcoholism. And it never gets treated, but there's a continually new series of breakthroughs. A new salt vaccine about every 18 months that just makes it all wonderful. And then it turns out it doesn't work. I was thinking, you know, the history of the treatment of alcoholism, just quickly, it's in my lifetime at any rate, it's been kind of funny. The first primary all-time major study of alcoholism that I've ever heard of or ever knew of was the Yale Institute of Alcoholic Studies in the 1950s. And it later went into Rutgers, where it got a little dissipated in other therapeutics. But this was a big breakthrough, that alcoholism became something socially acceptable, at least as far as Yale University. And they studied over a period of years all kinds of alcoholics and all kinds of people. They examined them for their backgrounds, they examined them for their sociology, for their intellectuality, for their emotional stability, for their intellectual attainments. All kinds of backgrounds. They're trying to find anything uniform that they could identify what makes an alcoholic an alcoholic. And this went on for some time. They got down to the point where they would give known alcoholics, say, like 3 drinks, and known non-alcoholics 3 drinks, and try to measure the difference. What is happening here? Because they really didn't know. They had some outstanding people working on this. And in fact, I thought about that many times. It wouldn't have been fun to be in that test, you know, have your three drinks and then mark down the reaction and say, well, that's all the test for today.
Like hell it is. Give me the goddamn bottle.
But they studied all kinds of alcoholics, and they came up with, of all of these people they studied, they only found two factors that seemed to be present in the vast majority of the known alcoholics they studied. One they could identify vaguely. One they could spot, but could not measure it. And the first one was, of course, the known non-alcoholic, or the known alcoholics, seemed to, after the same amount of alcohol as a known non-alcoholic, would have a more significant personality change. They didn't know why. They couldn't measure it. They seemed to act a little different. They didn't act crazy. They just looked a little different. And the other thing that they all seemed to have in common, the closest they had of anything they had in common, they all measured very high on their psychological profile. They all measured extremely high in perfectionism. All highly perfectionism and getting a reaction from alcohol. And of course, as I've thought many times, if they would have known what we know today, they could have asked him another question and found out one other unifying factor. They could have asked him, and they would have found out that each one of their known alcoholics, deep in their hearts, knew his case was different. Because if there's any unifying fact we have, that's it. And they studied this. They did a lot of research, but nothing came out of it much. They got some additional data, because it turned out knowledge is not sufficient. Then in the ensuing years, in my experience, and it became something of a hobby, reading about how people are making new breakthroughs in alcoholism, just in Southern California alone, we have a church-supported hospital out in Redlands, White Memorial. It used to be in Los Angeles. Part of it is in Redlands now. And they are very much anti-drinking. But they decided in the 1960s to put in an alcoholic treatment facility. And I learned a great deal about it because they ran two full pages in the Los Angeles Times how this anti-drinking church is curing alcoholism. And what they did, what it boils down to, you'd go into the hospital sick and desperate, and they'd lead you into a ward that they had set up as a bar. And go in there and have a little drink. The guy said, "You want a drink, sir? What are you serving here? Whiskey? Okay. Ah! You religious people know how to treat alcoholics. Give me another one." And they had little glasses that had little cords on them, I guess, so they wouldn't steal the glasses. Day after day, they come in, they get a little something going and know that they were in the right place. One day, it would turn out, after they'd been there a few days, they'd have a little drink, and they'd shoot an electric shock through that cord. That's what the cord was for.
No more ice in the next one, Al.
And then they'd have another drink, and there'd be no electric shock. Ah, that's more like it. And you'd have another drink. And after a while, after a few days of this, these guys were like fawns in the forest fire, you know. They just, they're going. Crazy. And after a while, these poor boobs would come in and say, "You want a drink?"
"No, I don't believe I want one today."
And another cure went down on the books. And they ran a big story about this, about the cures of alcoholism. And like so many cures, of course, it only lasted till some enterprising agent did a follow-up. And they discovered after these cured guys left, most of them didn't get by the first place that didn't have cords on their glasses. You know? I remember reading about a doctor down in Albuquerque. And he had and this got some ink in the Los Angeles Times. Everything gets ink in the Los Angeles Times. And he had a deal where he would take movies of his drunken patients when they were drunk and sick and throwing up. And then when this guy sobered up again and felt like drinking, you'd go by the office, you'd run a reel or two, and say, is that the way you want to be? No. And that got a lot of coverage as a cure. And then it turned out more and more patients didn't have time for the movies on their way to the bar.
I'll go to the movies later. Let's have a drink now, for Christ's sake.
Well, yeah. The classic one is still being used, of course. It was 1955 when they first began putting out Anabuse. Now, there's an answer. And a great many doctors to this day believe in it. Now, if you take this pill, you can't drink. We all know that. And it turns out two things happen. The smarter ones forget to take their Anabuse for a couple days. Oh, damn it. I forgot to take my Anabuse. Well, I guess there's no help for it now. And the other ones, not quite so smart, but a little more macho.
Screw them and screw their Anabuse.
And their face gets red, they wind up in the hospital. And time and cure after cure. We all remember that terrible, ill-fated thing put out by the Rand Corporation, Santa Monica. One of the people who worked on that was an AA in my group. And I asked him about that. He said, well, that seems to be how it goes. Of course, you notice they issued a demurrer on there. It said, Rand Corporation says alcoholics can drink again. Except those that can't. That's like the weatherman saying 40% chance of rain. He can't miss, you know. Well, I guess the 40% didn't come up, you know. Guess you were in the 60% area. The follow-up they did on that was, as we all know, just hideous. And they had done a follow-up. And they said, according to their follow-up, the first follow-up they did, everything is fine. These people are doing well. And it wasn't until the second or third follow-up done by an independent doctor in North Carolina that discovered these people were dying. And they said, how in the hell did you do your follow-up? They asked the Rand Corporation. And they said, well, we called them regularly and asked them how they were doing. And you just have to laugh. You could just see some poor puke somewhere pulling himself up to the phone. Yeah, everything's still all right with me. And on and on. And the treatments, I remember, some of you may remember this, I haven't thought about this for years. 1961 in Harper's Magazine. Big article. AA, cult or cure? And that took the nation by storm. In 1963 or 64, I was working in the television station in Los Angeles as a promotion director. And I noticed that the author of this article was doing an on-air interview on our station with something to do about alcoholism and its recovery. And I stood behind the camera and glared at this guy. He couldn't see me because of the lights, but it made me feel better, you know. I went up to him afterwards and I said, where did you get your information on AA? I was interested in your article. Then he also wrote a book. He said, well, and he reeked terribly. He said, well, I've been slipping a lot in AA, and I guess I shouldn't say those things, but that's the way it seemed at the time. But, you know, all the people who read it was convinced that you can't go there. There's always a recovery something. There's always a new thing. There's always a new treatment. And yet, the same amount of people are dying. Treatment centers today, excellent, wonderful places, dedicated people running them. And they still turn out mostly failures. None of the literature says so, but you and I know that. I wish it weren't. Detoxification facilities turn out failures only quicker. Hospitals. There are no, with all the answers and so many people believing that recovery is possible, you know and I know deep in our hearts that recovery from alcoholism is an illusion. And people who are familiar with us don't seem to be aware of it. And it's easy to explain why well-meaning professionals don't understand it. But it's hard to imagine that they can understand it when people like me, who almost died from it, died once, brought back to life, and then almost died again, can't understand it. And the great illusion, I suppose, the great misconception about recovery that still troubles most people who deal with alcoholics, who treat alcoholics, who actually are in there dealing and counseling them, is that grave misconception. If you're sober and seem to be getting along all right, you're better. And the great burden is to find out that is not true. I suppose it would be safe to say that the percentage of recovery in alcoholism isn't a hell of a lot different than it's ever been today, in the sense of the vast, way over 90% of people who are alcoholics will die directly or indirectly from it. They will move into brain damage. They will move into irreversible brain damage. They will not always die face down on the sidewalk on Skid Row. Only 3% of alcoholics are on Skid Row. But the vast protected people, going for treatment, finding answers, knowing truth, understanding the problem, and then in a relatively short time, down the toilet again. It baffles the people who treat them. It baffles their families. It baffles their surrounding environmental peers. But most lethally, it baffles the patient. And that's why it's almost imperative to begin with the concept that knowing all about this problem is no answer. That's why it's such a difficult thing. Some of the great authorities in the treatment of alcoholism did fine until they confronted their own alcoholism. I remember years ago I knew a young man who wrote the major textbook on alcoholic counseling. And he was his colleague is still active. They wrote the major book on alcoholic counseling, the major textbook, the number one textbook. And the book hadn't been out very long when the guy was discharged by his big corporation because he could not stay sober on the job. And he would come to AA, for example, and he was very uncomfortable there. He said, I know more than all of the people in this room put together about alcoholism. Why can't I stay sober? And he would treat these ordinary people with some disdain, and I understood that. But the fact was, he went down the toilet like all the rest of them. Dead, drunk, sick, yet people are still leafing through his textbook, finding out how to treat alcoholics. And I'm certain that what he wrote was correct. I have not read the entire book, but the parts I read seem to be true. But it all gets down to that grave misconception that somehow, if we know enough, it'll get better. Somehow, if we can take our patient and teach him these facts, it'll get better. Somehow, we will turn him around. Now, you and I both know. Maybe you've heard it. At least I've heard it. I haven't heard it recently, but a few months ago. There was a series of commercials. I heard them on the radio a lot. Not so much on television, on the radio. Man up in Seattle guarantees to cure your alcoholism in 30 days. He says, I know it's possible because I was a problem drinker and I stopped. And he didn't make any bones about it. I don't think I have to worry about breaking his anonymity because he was on the radio saying who he was. He runs Schick Shadel. And he says, at Schick Shadel, we will cure alcoholism in 30 days. And he has recoveries to prove it. I'm sure he has a lot of people who are not recovered. But he has some recoveries to prove it. But I remember 15 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, when Schick Shadel was guaranteeing that they could return alcoholics to social drinking. In fact, I went to a lecture. Their director of their program was a recovered alcoholic, and he would lecture. I went to one of them. At the end of the lecture, he held up a martini and drank it. And I'll tell you, that caught your attention if you were going through one of your moods. That's a pretty hard thing to party, pretty hard thing to debate in.
I don't believe you're doing that.
You know. Well, that was a great, significant breakthrough, except about a short time later, a few weeks later, the director was in a padded cell in Seattle. So then they moved a little towards abstinence for some. But I don't think these are, I'm not ridiculing these people. These are people who seriously and earnestly mean what they say. Now, I think it's safe to say, I believe that there are probably types of alcoholics. There are those who are physiologically addicted to alcoholics. And that's unfortunately what most of the medical profession, I think, traditionally has seen as the alcoholic, the physiological addicted, the where the withdrawal is dreadful. This, you know, as has been said before, if you take, well, I hope you weren't turned off quite yet. I hadn't really got to the thrust of my remarks yet.
No sense wasting tape on this, son of a bitch.
You know, it's an old truism. If you take 30 people coming off advanced heroin addiction and lock them in a room, and you open that door in about 10 days, you're going to have 30 of the sickest people you ever saw in your life. You find 30 people in acute alcoholic withdrawal, take 30 of those and put them in a room and lock the door, and in 10 days you open it, you're going to have 15 of them dead. That's the difference. They're not going to be sick. They're going to be dead. Acute alcoholic withdrawal is really, as we all know, a life-taking thing sometimes. But this, where the physiology is changed by alcohol and it becomes a true addiction, and it's a lot of work to get them off. And some of these people, when they get off, are saying, hey, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I know a number of people who have seemed to have stopped drinking, sometimes through religious experience, sometimes through withdrawal medically, sometimes being terribly sick, and they seem to withdraw. And yet, most alcoholics aren't what you would consider to be this bad, but they're going to die from it. Why? Because I suppose they fall into the category which, it's a phrase I used to hear and it didn't make much sense to me in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics of our type. What are alcoholics of our type? How much do you have to drink to be an alcoholic of our type? How crazy does it have to make you to be an alcoholic of our type? And that is not the measurement at all. The biggest single misconception that I know about the treatment of this problem is that there are still a lot of people, and some of them working actively in the field, who still believe alcohol, the removal of alcohol, will make the patient better. And removal from alcohol and information, that'll somehow make you better. And it's a continual sadness, both to the patient and to the help, that it doesn't work that way. Why not? Why not? You know, we all know these facts, but it's nice to reinforce them once in a while. Why wouldn't anyone who was just being bedeviled by this evil rum, when they get off it and get straightened up, why don't you shape up? Straighten up. Why drink that? Look what it's doing to you. And now, since I've been sober a number of years and doing these things, I can, but not really, understand people who don't understand us. Jesus. Yeah. And yet, after all of these years, I still do not understand people who compulsively eat. I know they do it. Maybe there's some emotional gratification and there's some turn on, but Christ, can't you just eat like a human being, you know? Don't have another 3 gallons of ice cream tonight, say. Why don't you try a pint, you know? When OA first started, they didn't have any successful OA, so they had a couple of us people from AA go and talk to their first meeting out in Beverly Hills. And some of these people would participate. They're trying. We talked about the obsessive quality. I was very thin then. I used to look around with a lot of disdain at these fat old pukes, I'll tell you. Why can't you just be straight the way I am? Yeah. But we talk about emotionals and obsessions. And I remember hearing some of these women share. It was enough to make you just run, you know. And then I ate 2 cakes. Then I went in the washroom and put my finger down my throat and came back and ate some more. You are a sick bitch. I didn't say it because I've always been gracious, but I thought it. A person like you shouldn't be allowed out. I don't understand people. I've just gone through this again with a guy whose life is on the line and yet went back to Las Vegas on the sly with his last paycheck and went one more time, and now he's down the toilet. Again and again, watching people gamble and go down. I got a guy that I sponsored a few years ago in AA was doing very well, and it turned out that he was gambling on the side. You know how I happened to find out he was gambling on the side? Because the FBI called me and told they'd arrest him at the bank he was robbing to pay his gambling losses. That was bad enough, but that was his fourth bank. He hadn't been caught the first 3 times. He didn't share with his sponsor, the son of a bitch. You know. He never did drink. He didn't sink to that. You know, he always... I must say, in his behalf, I said to him once, I said, you know, how can you rob banks? And I said, you've always done whatever I told you. He said, you never told me not to rob banks. Well, now I try to remember to tell that to newcomers. And, oh, by the way, but I don't understand these obsessions. And yet, mine was as bad or worse, and I could not understand it. And I had the ongoing great symptom of my illness. Deep in my heart, I knew I didn't really have it. Knew I didn't really have it. Every day today, almost every day today, I watch people die from alcoholism. Most of you will not have that opportunity, nor do you want it. Most every day today, I watch people move into irreversible brain damage. And I've spent a lot of time over the years talking to these people, and the one thing they all know, they are not really alcoholics. Not really. Their case is different. And it's funny until you watch the guy die. I remember, tell you a good lesson about that. No information changes. A few months ago, or about a year ago now, a little over a year ago, we have guys dying around here and there, usually not out in the open. This guy had a convulsion in the doorway. And we called the paramedics. He's laying there. And I was trying to get something between his teeth when all of a sudden he stiffened and died. So he lay there. The paramedics got there. He was dead. So they put a sheet over him. You have to wait for the police to make a report before you can move the body. So they sat in the truck and had a cigarette, or their ambulance had a cigarette, and for about an hour till the police got there, because deaths on Skid Row are not the top priority to the police, or should they be. But everyone that came in or out, hundreds of people stepping over this dead body on their way to have a drink. And now you think, people really shouldn't do that, you know. That doesn't seem very wise. But that's right out in the open. But most people like me have done things equally as egregious as that, only it's concealed and masqueraded and hidden and rationalized and justified, because somehow or other I did not understand the concept of my illness. Of all the information I got, I still knew I am not drinking, and I feel hideous. I have anxiety. I have frustration. I am surrounded by callous people I have insecurities that I can't measure. And God damn it, at least when I have a few drinks, it evens it off. What I must do is not drink too much. I didn't understand then or for a long time thereafter. That is almost the classic case of the illness. It takes a while to understand the difference between an alcohol problem, which may be caused by an addiction or situational drinking, and this disease of alcoholism. And it boils down to this. An alcohol problem, obviously, when you stop the patient drinking, you have overcome the problem. You may have some residual cleanups to do, but pretty much that's it. But almost no one ever seems to realize the difference between that and alcoholism. And the strange and peculiar thing in the disease of alcoholism, stopping drinking has no significant effect except to make life progressively deep feeling. Alienation, difference, feelings of insecurity usually masked behind walls of false arrogance, defiance. I don't need anything. Remember, once upon a time, in one of my rare moments of any kind of perception, when I'd been stopped by a highway patrol and given the test for drunken driving in Texas, I was directing a grand opera at the university, and I was just en route to the Texas Insane Asylum, where I was about to direct the Christmas pageant. I hadn't planned to, but that's how it worked out. But, you know, it's not so bad directing a Christmas pageant. It isn't like an opera, as I like to say. Operas, you have to give movement and meaning of it. Nuthouse Christmas pageant, you just try to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary if you possibly can. Get back there, Lamar.
Which one to worship her?
Hey, I remember thinking sometime later when I was somewhere doing something, it must have been maybe a year later, I was thinking, it's too bad, somewhere in the world, they don't have a balloon you could blow up so that people know how much anxiety you got. It's too bad they don't have a white line to walk so that someone could understand that beneath my defiance is a little boy who would like his mother, or someone to care for me, or someone to love me and nurture. It's too bad they can't take a drop of blood out of my ear. I said, this guy's problem is he feels different. Let's reinforce him. Build him up. But they have no measurements for that. Because if you're a drinker, the answer is stopping drinking. And there's no way either the people I talked to, the hospitals I went to, the sanitaria I went to, there were any treatment centers, but sanitaria, the various therapeutics I went through, the psychiatrist I spent thousands of dollars with, never anyone understood, nor did I. I wouldn't have understood if they had told me that you do not have an alcohol problem, boy. You suffer from alcoholism, and the primary thrust of alcoholism is that sobriety is untenable on a continual basis. Can be protected. That's a funny thing. I think about this when I visit treatment centers sometimes. People kind of hate treatment centers, but there's one thing there that we forget about. They are in a protected environment. They are in an environment that someone is controlling. I remember years ago, again in the 1950s, I didn't think about this till the 1960s. I was a terrible nail biter most of my life. Just an habitual thing, as many nervous people are. My wife pointed out to me, some years after this, she said, you know, the only time you stopped biting your nails for all those years was when you were in the insane asylum. And I hated it there. I escaped once. They brought me back, gave me electric shock treatment. They just abused me terribly. They couldn't stand smart Yankees. That was my story anyway. But you want to know something? I look back upon it. I was in a protected environment. As much as I hated the decisions, I didn't have to make them somehow. And that's the hard thing to remember, because I think when we have people come through treatment and they spend the 30 days or a week or 10 days or 90 days, and it's great, and we put them in the world again, and they're full of data, they're straightened up, they're cleaned up, and the rate of failure is much higher than anyone would ever like to publicly state. And we know that to be true. We have successes, but it's not a very high rate. Still, it's almost embarrassing that still the best rate of recovery is in something like AA, which is made up of well-meaning simpleton laymen. There's something basically wrong with that. I sponsor a psychiatrist in AA, and he gave me that story for some time, and I told him he thought that was unfair. Just think, he's getting $100 a day in the city of Santa, $100 an hour. There's the young lady who sent him to me. $100 an hour and for giving people misinformation all day long. And I have to save him at night for nothing. For something. Now that's wrong. That's wrong. But what makes AA different? AA and such therapeutics, I guess there are other ways to stay sober. A few years ago, the National Council used to have me go out and talk at various public functions. They're a good group and they do a good job. But at that time, the administrator, and I guess they have to do it for their own purposes, but they'd always have me talk and they'd say, here's an example of one of the ways to stay sober. He is an AA. There are many other ways. And I'd gone out about 10 different times with these people. It suddenly struck me, I'm the only one ever going out. And so I called them and I said, I'm not going out again unless you have representatives of the other ways to stay sober on that goddamn platform with me. It's been 15 years now. It looks like they're not going to call. Well, I know this has to be done that way, but the hard thing to remember is there is no treatment that seems to work with the disease of alcoholism because sobriety is the enemy. Drinking is the friend, and now it's become a destructive friend, but drinking is the respite. Why is it the respite? Why would anyone drink? Because the other end of the equation is not just that sobriety is untenable, but it's untenable for a very good reason. Alcohol has a special effect on some bodies, and we hear that bandied about, and God, over the years I've heard people talk about how they can take the spinal flap tap and find extra fluids in the alcoholic, and there's a metabolic differences, but to the best of my knowledge, I may be wrong, unless this conference has a breakthrough, I know of no physiological way to measure an alcoholic's body that I've ever heard of. There may be one, but I have not heard of it that's a valid one, because would it be easy to measure? We wouldn't have to go through this trial and error for 20 years. But alcohol has a special effect. What is this effect? Makes you drunk all the time? No. I used to think it made you drunk all the time. That's one of the reasons I knew I was an alcoholic. So I wasn't drunk all the time. Made Jack crazy all the time? Didn't make me crazy all the time. And today I see guys dying every day who've never acted crazy once. They're just wimps laying there dying. The special effect is something, it turns out, as far as I can determine from all the data I've been able to collect and listen to and from my betters and observe, and that special effect is one that I never would have guessed. I would have died and been in my grave for 25 years and never guessed it. The special effect is, it turns out, isn't what alcohol does to me at all. Alcohol does something special for me that it doesn't do for most people. It almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It almost instantly changes my relationship to my environment, where that environment may be. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening. I knew it did that, but I didn't know it was a significant thing. I thought it did that to everybody. And if people didn't drink much, all that tells me is they don't have the problems and conflicts I have. And it turns out it doesn't do that for them. Probably the best example of that I know, when I was finally had made about a year sober after slipping for many years, you know, sometimes when I talk, it's almost as though you could hear angels singing. Whoever's listening to this tape goes, like, what's that dumb bitch talking about now? Anyway, when I was about a year sober, I was working, and finally, I had a slow recovery. I had a wonderful resume. I'd been an award-winning writer. I used to work on these L.C. Nelmer ads for the Borden Company. I directed an opera at the University of Texas. I done a lot of things. Ads I was writing were running in big magazines. And at the end of my first year, somebody, the first best job I'd had was been a janitor in a jewelry store. And the guy fired me because he thought I was dusting too long amongst the watches, which cuts into your resume a little bit, the hole there. But I finally got a job in the back wrapping packages in an advertising agency. The same kind of job that I had when I was 14 years old. Now, this is what you call rocket to stardom through the alcoholic recovery program. And I didn't have any front teeth. They'd been kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank through a series of bad breaks. So I was a little credibility, and I finally learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people didn't know I didn't have front teeth. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire. And one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. And I had a mean sponsor. For instance, one of the reasons I didn't have any front teeth, I had some money for front teeth. He said, send that to your children in Dallas.
Jesus Christ, they got front teeth.
Over there. And there's always a few guys that say, hey, you want an apple, buddy? Ha, 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 ha. But one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. That's a Southern California big item down here. They have billboards. They've had the same billboards for 30 years. They changed them briefly last year. I've noticed they're changing them back. And it's always the same. It always says, vodka is pronounced Kamchatka. And I was back there wrapping my packs with me. That's a corny billboard. It's a corny slogan. And I'm a creative, prize-winning writer. So I waited one day, the guys were working on a new billboard. They never changed the word, just the coloration, the type styles, and I had a package, some packages coming by. It's none of my business, though. But I got kind of an idea maybe you'd like to look at. How about this for a slogan? Kamchatka Vodka goes boom. Better than all vodkas anywhere. And they looked at me with the same look I've been getting all my life. You know, that's supposed to be funny, and one of the guys said, you know, you got a reputation for being a smart mouth anyway. The mouth you got, it shouldn't be smart. He said, you know, if you don't like the way we artists and writers do things, why don't you go wrap your goddamn packages somewhere else? And just on and on, just humiliated me. I was just ready to scream. If I wouldn't have had to report it to my sponsor, I'd have jumped the table and killed him. And that afternoon, I was making my plans to run away, die. And I saw my sponsor that night, I said, Bob! Shut up, he explained. For Christ's sake, if you can't be a man, act like one. He said, tell me, now what the hell's wrong? Keep it down. And I told him the story.
You got to give him a slogan, I'm going to have to use it, but at least I could listen, for Christ's sake. Be a man.
And he got all done. Don't you know anything? When he was mad, he used to wave his finger in my face. That's the only time I ever really missed my front teeth. I just...
I didn't want to give him the pleasure of gumming it.
He said, listen, haven't you been listening to what I've been telling you for the last year? They're not humiliating you, that agency. They're not putting you down. They just don't know what the hell you're talking about. Can't you understand that? Kamchatka Vodka doesn't go boom to them. To them, Kamchatka Vodka goes blue. That's why you're in this goddamn meeting and they're not.
Oh, I said, I could have told you that.
What are the great examples? If alcohol goes boom for me, it's a great thing. It works better than any drug I've ever heard of. It doesn't pull you down like heroin. You don't OD on it like heroin. You don't get crazy and holes in your nose and paranoid like cocaine. You just get right in the middle and you feel better. Boom. Screw you, household finance. That's what you call your basic all-time therapy, boy. But if it does that for you, it gradually erodes, apparently, your emotional skills, whatever skills you have left of coping with reality. No one is going to spend 2 weeks working through a severely painful emotional problem when they can change the problem in 5 minutes. So, but eventually alcohol begins to do something to you, too, as it must when you pour it into your body. But by that time, alcohol begins to do something to you. But by that time, reality, sustained realities, become full of sharp corners and untenable. And the curse of the disease of alcoholism is that sooner or later the patient must drink again. And all the knowledge doesn't make any difference. An obsession will blot out all data you've got. I will tell you that. It's the same concept my sponsor taught me this once. It's so hideously corny, I hate to say it to learned people. But he said, there's a penny, kid. You wouldn't even pick it up on the corner. If you hold it close enough to your eye, it blots out the whole world. Put it out here, you wouldn't even pick it up. Sponsor taught me this once. It's so hideously corny, I hate to say it to learned people. But he said, there's a penny, kid. You wouldn't even pick it up on the corner. If you hold it close enough to your eye, it blots out the whole world. Put it out here, you wouldn't even pick it up. And that's just the way it is with your emotions. When they're up close, they blot out the world. And all we do here is to push them away so we can see them in perspective and see what we have to do and what not to do. But how do you overcome it? And it turns out the only generally therapeutic way to overcome it is to take an alcoholic who cannot live in reality and have him live in reality. But how do you live in reality? Knowledge won't do it. It turns out you need a sustaining series of things that will lessen the emotional pressures. I think it's an old truism. I don't think I have to explain this to anybody. But it's what the deprivations I had. It was because the loss of my love. It was because I had my love. But on and on. But always primarily down to that one deep feeling. Alienation. Difference. Feelings of insecurity, usually masked behind walls of false arrogance, defiance. I don't need anything. Remember once upon a time, in one of my rare moments of any kind of perception, when I'd been stopped by a highway patrol and given the test for drunken driving in Texas. And I was directing a grand opera at the university, and I was just en route to the Texas Insane Asylum where I was about to direct the Christmas pageant. I hadn't planned to, but that's how it worked out. But, you know, it's not so bad directing a Christmas pageant. It isn't like an opera, as I like to say. Operas, you have to give movement and meaning. The Nuthouse Christmas pageant, you just try to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary if you possibly can. Get back there, Lamar.
We just want to worship her.
I remember thinking sometime later when I was somewhere doing something, must have been maybe a year later, I was thinking, it's too bad, somewhere in the world, they don't have a balloon you could blow up so that people know how much anxiety you got. It's too bad they don't have a white line to walk so that someone could understand that beneath my defiance is a little boy who would like his mother, or someone to care for me, or someone to love me and nurture me. It's too bad they can't take a drop of blood out of my ear. I said, this guy's problem is he feels different. Let's reinforce him. Build him up. But they have no measurements for that. Because if you're a drinker, the answer is stopping drinking. And there's no way either the people I talked to, the hospitals I went to, the sanitaria I went to, there weren't any treatment centers, but sanitaria, the various therapeutics I went through, the psychiatrists I spent thousands of dollars with, never anyone understood, nor did I. And I wouldn't have understood if they'd have told me that you do not have an alcohol problem, boy. You suffer from alcoholism, and the primary thrust of alcoholism is that sobriety is untenable on a continual basis. Can we protect? That's a funny thing. I think about this when I visit treatment centers sometimes. People kind of hate treatment centers, but there's one thing there that we forget about. They are in a protected environment. They are in an environment that someone is controlling. I remember years ago, again in the 1950s, I didn't think about this till the 1960s. I was a terrible nail biter most of my life. Just a habitual thing, as many nervous people are. My wife pointed out to me, some years after this, she said, you know, the only time you stopped biting your nails for all those years was when you were in the insane asylum. And I hated it there. I escaped once. They brought me back, gave me electric shock treatment. They just abused me terribly. They couldn't stand smart Yankees. That was my story anyway. But you want to know something? I look back upon it. I was in a protected environment. As much as I hated the decisions, I didn't have to make them somehow. And that's the hard thing to remember, because I think when we have people come to your treatment and they spend the 30 days or a week or 10 days or 90 days, and it's great, and we put them in the world again, and they're full of data, they're straightened up, they're cleaned up, and the rate of failure is much higher than anyone would ever like to publicly state. And we know that to be true. We have successes, but it's not a very high rate. Still, it's almost embarrassing that still the best rate of recovery is in something like AA, which is made up of well-meaning simpleton laymen. There's something basically wrong with that. I sponsor a psychiatrist in AA, and he gave me that story for some time, and I told him he thought that was unfair. Just think, he's getting $100 a day in the city of Santa, $100 an hour. There's the young lady who sent him to me. $100 an hour and for giving people misinformation all day long. And I have to save him at night for nothing. There's something... Now, that's wrong. That's wrong. But what makes AA different? AA and such therapeutics, I guess there are other ways to stay sober. A few years ago, the National Council used to have me go out and talk at various public functions. They're a good group, and they do a good job. But at that time, the administrator, and I guess they have to do it for their own purposes, but they'd always have me talk, and they'd say, here's an example of one of the ways to stay sober. He is an AA. There are many other ways. And I'd gone out about 10 different times with these people, and it suddenly struck me, I'm the only one ever going out. And so I called them and I said, I'm not going out again unless you have representatives of the other ways to stay sober on that goddamn platform. It's been 15 years now, it looks like they're not going to call. Well, I know this has to be done that way, but the hard thing to remember is there is no treatment that seems to work with the disease of alcoholism, because sobriety is the enemy. Drinking is the friend, and now it's become a destructive friend, but drinking is the respite. Why is it the respite? Why would anyone drink? Because the other end of the equation is not just that sobriety is untenable, but it's untenable for a very good reason. Alcohol has a special effect on some bodies, and we hear that bandied about, and God, over the years I've heard people talk about how they can take the spinal flap, tap and find extra fluids in the alcoholic, and there's a metabolic differences. But to the best of my knowledge, I may be wrong, unless this conference has a breakthrough, I know of no physiological way to measure an alcoholic's body that I've ever heard of. There may be one, but I have not heard of it. That's a valid one. Because would it be easy to measure? We wouldn't have to go through this trial and error for 20 years. But alcohol has a special effect. What is this effect? Makes you drunk all the time? No. I used to think it made you drunk all the time. That's one of the reasons I knew I was an alcoholic. I wasn't drunk all the time. Made Jack crazy all the time? Didn't make me crazy all the time. And today I see guys dying every day who've never acted crazy once. They're just wimps laying there dying. The special effect is something, it turns out, as far as I can determine from all the data I've been able to collect and listen to and from my betters and observe, and that special effect is one that I never would have guessed. I would have died and been in my grave for 25 years and never guessed it. The special effect is, it turns out, this is what alcohol does to me at all. Alcohol does something special for me, that it doesn't do for most people. It almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It almost instantly changes my relationship to my environment, whatever that environment may be. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening. I knew it did that, but I didn't know it was a significant thing. I thought it did that to everybody. And if people didn't drink much, all that tells me is they don't have the problems and conflicts I have. And it turns out it doesn't do that for them. Probably the best example of that I know, when I was finally had made about a year sober after slipping for many years, you know, sometimes when I talk, it's almost though you could hear angels singing. Whoever's listening to this tape goes, hey, what that dumb bitch talking about now? Anyway, when I was about a year sober, I was working, and finally, I had a slow recovery. I had a wonderful resume. I'd been an award-winning writer. I used to work on these L.C. Nelmer ads for the Borden Company. I directed an opera at the University of Texas. I'd done a lot of things. Ads I was writing were running in big magazines. And at the end of my first year, somebody, the first best job I'd had has been a janitor in a jewelry store. And the guy fired me because he thought I was dusting too long amongst the watches, which cuts into your resume a little bit, the hole there. But I finally got a job in the back wrapping packages in an advertising agency. The same kind of job that I had when I was 14 years old. Now, this is what you call rocket to stardom through the alcoholic recovery program. And I didn't have any front teeth. They'd been kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank through a series of bad breaks. So I was a little credibility, and I finally learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people didn't know I didn't have front teeth. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire. And one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. And I had a mean sponsor. For instance, one of the reasons I didn't have any front teeth, I had some money for front teeth. Here. Send that to your children in Dallas.
Jesus Christ, they got front teeth.
Well, there. And there's always a few guys saying, hey, you want an apple, buddy? Ha, 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 ha. But one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. That's a Southern California big item down here. They have billboards. They've had the same billboards for 30 years. They changed them briefly last year. Now I've noticed they're changing them back. And it's always the same. It always says, vodka is pronounced Kamchatka. And I was back there wrapping my packs with me. That's a corny one. Billboard. It's a corny slogan. And I'm a creative, prize-winning writer. So I waited one day. The guys were working on a new billboard. They never changed the word, just the coloration, the type styles. And I had a package, some packages coming by. It's none of my business, but I got kind of an idea maybe you'd like to look at. How about this for a slogan? Kamchatka Vodka goes, boom. Better than all vodkas anywhere. And they looked at me with the same look I've been getting all my life. You know, this. That's supposed to be funny, and one of the guys said, you know, you got a reputation for being a smart mouth anyway. The mouth you got, it shouldn't be smart. He said, you know, if you don't like the way we artists and writers do things, why don't you go wrap your goddamn packages somewhere else? And just on and on, just humiliated me. I was just ready to scream. If I wouldn't have had to report it to my sponsor, I'd have jumped the table and killed him. And that afternoon, I was making my plans to run away, die. And I saw my sponsor that night. I said, Bob! Shut up, he explained. For Christ's sake, if you can't be a man, act like one. He said, tell me. Now, what the hell's wrong? Keep it down. And I told him the story.
He got everything. Give me a slogan. I didn't have to use it, but at least I could listen. For Christ's sake.
And he got all done. He said, listen. Haven't you been listening to what I've been telling you for the last year? They're not humiliating you, that agency. They're not putting you down. They just don't know what the hell you're talking about. Can't you understand that? Kamchatka Vodka doesn't go boom to them. To them, Kamchatka vodka goes blah. That's why you're in this goddamn meeting and they're not. Oh, I said I could have told you that. Go to the great example. If alcohol goes boom for me, it's a great thing. It works better than any drug I've ever heard of. It doesn't pull you down like heroin. You don't OD on it like heroin. You don't get crazy and holes in your nose and paranoid like cocaine. You just get right in the middle and you feel better. Boom. Screw you, household finance. Now, that's what you call your basic all-time therapy, boy. But if it does that for you, it gradually erodes, apparently, your emotional skills, whatever skills you have left of coping with reality. No one is going to spend 2 weeks working through a severely painful emotional problem when they can change the problem in 5 minutes. So, but eventually alcohol begins to do something to you, too, as it must when you pour it into your body. But by that time, alcohol begins to do something to you. But by that time, reality, sustained realities, become full of sharp corners and untenable. And the curse of the disease of alcoholism is that sooner or later the patient must drink again. And all the knowledge doesn't make any difference. An obsession will blot out all data you've got. I will tell you that. It's the same concept my sponsor taught me this once. It's so hideously corny, I hate to say it to learned people. But he said, there's a penny, kid. You wouldn't even pick it up on a corner. If you hold it close enough to your eye, it blots out the whole world. Put it out here, you wouldn't even pick it up. And that's just the way it is with your emotions. When they're up close, they blot out the world. And all we do here is to push them away so we can see them in perspective and see what we have to do and what not to do. But how do you overcome it? And it turns out the only generally therapeutic way to overcome it is to take an alcoholic who cannot live in reality and have him live in reality. But how do you live in reality? Knowledge won't do it. It turns out you need a sustaining series of things that will lessen the emotional pressures. I think it's an old truism. I don't think I've explained this to anybody. But any time that you have the power of the intellect against the power of intense emotions, and they're fighting for control, sooner or later, the emotions will always win. Sooner or later, they will always win. That's why people like me, and I'm sure like all human beings, sooner or later, when you have strong emotions, you try to strengthen this side. You read good literature. You read, you get insights, you find knowledge, you try to get data, anything to hold the power of that conscious will to keep those goddamn emotions from screwing me up some more. But sooner or later, the emotions always win. There seems to be no amount of data, information, knowledge, strength that will hold intense emotions in check. And if they're not held in check, they must surely, for the alcoholic, lead to drinking. Or taking those stinking pills that dull the pain, but just, you don't even have any comfort then, just dull nothing. And it turns out the concept of AA is based upon acting better than you are. Acting yourself sober. Acting yourself well. Now it's known as kind of a new thing. UCLA is just introducing it into their mental ward and their emotional ward. They're all very thrilled with it. They've got this new therapy where they give people actions and don't ask them how they think. I thought, that sounds familiar. I bet I could have made it in that ward. I could have been leader of my platoon in bed, I'll bet. But the therapy of action, the whole concept of action, you cannot strengthen or intelligently get enough power to hold those emotions in. The actions do nothing for them. You could know all about AA, you could recite chapter 5, you could be a wizard and quote from the book and know all about it, and you still get drunk. And it happens a lot. The actions of AA have nothing to do with the power of your intellect to control those emotions. They seem to bleed off the pressure on the emotions on the other side. They don't work on what you're doing. They're working on things you can't see on the subliminal end of it. That is what I think, you know, the difference between AA and any other therapy that deals with alcoholism seems to be this. Almost any therapy says, you come to us, we will change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change. AA, whether by blind luck or design or supernatural interference or whatever the hell it happened, winds up saying, you come to us, we will change your actions, and eventually your thinking will change. You must have something to do while you're waiting for your thinking to get better, because it may be some time. We don't ever say that because it discourages the newcomer, but we like to have them think there's an aura of magic. And the aura of, that's why sponsorship is such a valuable thing. It's a funny thing around the country, if you are familiar with AA. Areas of strong sponsorship have enthusiastic AA. Areas of weak sponsorship have flaccid and dull AA. Because they're not, no one's there motivating them to take the action. The actions are what do it and bring you the excitement and the enthusiasm. I think the greatest gift anyone ever gets, and I've had it most of the time for the last few years, is finding enthusiasm, taking enough actions so that you become enthusiastic about what used to be a lethal environment. And I like that word enthusiasm. It comes from the Greek root, en within, theos, God. All enthusiasm means is the Greeks trying to describe the God within. The God within. Whatever else they may find. The power without and the God within to get into. So I think what I'm, in a sense, I'm trying to say is that people like you and me must be very careful. Even though we know better, we still do it. Must be very careful to remember. Sobriety is not recovery. It is what you do after you get in sobriety that determines recovery. You know, we release people from treatment centers and therapies and full of guidance and counseling, but all of it is nearly all of it is absolutely worthless unless there's some place they go to continue to take actions that gradually bring about an emotional readjustment. And no matter how wonderful they are, they're going to screw that up from time to time. Because no matter what you do, you never rise above human beings. And human beings are terribly imperfect, even us. It's hard to believe. But you know, some days you're just wonderful, and other days you're just crappy. And you can prove why, but you're still crappy. Some days you have your ideals. I'm a veritable saint. Other days I just think I'm the goofiest puke that ever lived. And somewhere I'll have to live with it all. And pull down these swings. So I think that I don't like to beat the drum for Alcoholics Anonymous, but to the best of my knowledge, that's the only ongoing therapeutic that keeps people, alcoholics of our type, sober. And however good your therapy you may offer an alcoholic, when they get out of it, unless they go to AA, it's just a matter of time. Unless you're depending on repeat business, you're not doing them any favors. I'm glad to remember these facts. I'm glad to know these facts because it should color everything we know about alcoholism. Sobriety is not the goal. Sobriety is the entrance. And lack of sobriety is the exit, whether it may be a drink or a pill or a marijuana cigarette. Still, it's amazing that there are therapists in America who say, but at least he's not drinking. At least he is not drinking. The problem is not the drinking. The problem is the absence of the ability to cope with reality. And that's where the problem comes, to learn to cope in that reality. And it's an ongoing job. I've been given up on by the best doctors I knew, and now it's been almost 27 years since I've had a chemical in my body. And I haven't become wonderful. I still have to. Sometimes I get so discouraged at my emotional frailty, but it's better than it used to be. I've often thought, I am the weakest individual I have ever known. The most prone to rationalization and justification and temptation and runaway. And it makes me laugh sometimes because a lot of people around. Over the years, I've done a lot of things, been forced into taking action until they become habitual. And I guess there are things that make you strong. And a lot of people say, well, what I. In our meeting a lot, where people get to take birthday gifts, I want to thank Clancy for his consistency and strength. And I think, who? And I realize I am consistency and strength. Of myself, I am not. But actions which keep centering me, whichever way I go off, enable me to keep doing it. I hope that in any alcoholic you help, unless they be at one, you know, at one in the very few who suffer from only a physiological addiction, and once they swear off, they're wonderful again. But alcoholics of our type, which is the kind we see, I hope that you will be able from time to time to swallow all the information you know and to stuff it back down and say, you know, we can help you. But when we're done, you're not well. You must go there and center yourself in your environment or else you have no chance. It is easy not to say that. It is easy to let the man go and the misconception he is well and then find out that he's not well, because then you won't look bad. But I tell you, and I tell me, that if we want to make people better, if we want to have some degree of strength and stability and confidence that comes from helping people change their lives, we must say that we have gotten you straight enough, you're feeling better, you know what's wrong with you. Now it starts. When you leave here, now it starts. It's the same way I had a panel at Terminal Island Penitentiary for several years. They just got in for explaining these guys, and they all knew it. Boy, yeah, A is the answer. Until about a month before they got out. When I get out of here, boy, it's going to be all right. And I try to explain to them, look, Terminal Island didn't put you in Terminal Island. Out there where it's all right put you in Terminal Island. When you get out, it's going to be just as bad as ever. The treatment center didn't put you in the treatment center. And the state hospital didn't put you in the state hospital. Out there where it's going to be all right is where it's hell. And that's where we have to learn to live. I'm glad to be here tonight. I am glad to be a product of that environment. I am glad that as of today, to the best of my knowledge, and I read a lot, there is no recovery other than that sinister one that I've fallen into. I must feel good most of the time. And I better do what brings that about. Otherwise, I have the grave misconception I'm recovered and I'm dying, which is not what any of us are seeking. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank the invitation from the committee. I hope I will remember what I said tonight. I hope you do, but I insist that I do, because my life depends upon it. I want to thank you for your kindness.